Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Geert, and I'm very honored to be joined today by Professor Mark Schuilenburg. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you.
I'm glad you're here. Mark is a professor of digital surveillance at Erasmus University and also an assistant professor of criminology at the Vrije Universiteit in Amsterdam. Some of his recent work is that he published this book, The Securitization of Society, in 2015 with NYU Press, and also a bit longer ago in 2006, a volume called Mediapolis, published with O10 Publishers. But today we will be discussing with him his recent book, Hysteria, Crime, Media, and Politics, originally published in 2019 and translated into English last year. It was an exciting read. Maybe to start off with, Mark, going through the book, I was astounded by on the one hand, the philosophical wealth and the strong context of cultural history you exhibit. But on the other hand, combined with several bouts of rather urgent empirical research, I guess it was a great mix of scientific traditions. And I was wondering, where do you come from, professionally speaking?
Yeah. Professionally speaking, I have done philosophy. I have a master in philosophy and also a master in law. And I'm always interested in the sociological phenomena. And analyzing this sociological phenomena, as in this book, I always try to combine different methods. So on one hand, I like to make a philosophical analysis. But I also like to make this philosophical analysis more empirical. And that's why for this book, I've been in the archives of Rotterdam for almost a half year. And also I did a lot of empirical research in disadvantaged neighborhoods, where I talked for 2 years with persons who are living there. I visited all kind of what they are called neighborhood governance meetings. So I try to mix it up, this book, not only a pure philosophical point of view, although I talk and I try to extend the arguments of a lot of philosophers further in this book, amongst them like Michel Foucault, Gilles Deleuze, Zizek, and so on. But I also try to combine it, these philosophical arguments, which I make in this book, by empirical research to make the volume richer in its data and also richer than in its research by itself.
Yeah, and you see this theme, this great theme of hysteria, you see it in, you bring it in many different cultural settings as well. You see it in the arts, in current news items. When it comes to the book Hysteria, what was your specific point where you thought, okay, this is going to become a book?
Yeah. Well, it happened, I think, 4 or 5 years ago. As a professor in criminology and a professor in surveillance, I'm invited quite a quite often to give my opinion on television or radio or in the written paper in opinion articles. But especially when I'm on television and I'm interviewed, for instance, about the level of public safety in the Netherlands and in other European countries. And if I tell then the audience on public television that actually we live in a very, very safe society, then the other day I find dozens of angry emails in my email box. Scandalous, get a proper job, you're sucking up the left-wing press, educate yourself. These are among the least hostile comments I have received in recent years. I always mail these persons back and then start a conversation. And then I see that all the emotions and the frustration and the angriness by these people when I tell them that actually we are in a very safe place. So I wanted with this book to place these emotions and frustrations in a wider sociological perspective, which I hope I have received achieved in this book. And by doing this, taking grant of all the angriness and frustration that is in society, but placing this angriness and frustration in society not on an individual level, that were the emails, but on a broader historical, sociological, and in the end, philosophical perspective.
Maybe to get to the concept of hysteria, then, of course, originally and perhaps most prominently, hysteria was, it had a purely clinical definition. Maybe to go back to that, what did hysteria designate as an individual disease then?
Yeah, well, hysteria was always, it's the oldest disease actually of mankind. And it was always a big lemma in the DSM. And the DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatric Disorders. And this DSM is used by doctors worldwide to diagnose our conditions. And what struck me, and I didn't know that, is that at the end of the 1980s, hysteria disappeared from the handbook. From the DSM handbook. And I tried to find out what the reason was behind this, because we all know the whole idea of hysteria as emotions that pop up, screaming persons, all kind of behavior that's not, at least in our vision, rational anymore. So I tried to find out why hysteria does not exist anymore, at least as a medical diagnosis. And then you see all kind of arguments being made in and around the DSM. For instance, they want to get rid of the legacy of Sigmund Freud. And we all know that hysteria was for Sigmund Freud an important way of analyzing his cases, always female cases. So especially the American tradition of psychology has nothing more in common with the legacy of Sigmund Freud. We also see at that time that what comes up is evidence-based thinking. Evidence-based thinking that with clear methods, clear objectives, you can have some results. And whole the history of hysteria is very difficult to pinpoint at a clear definition, at a clear diagnosis, at a clear validity, and so on. And also, and that was, I think, the most important reason why hysteria is abandoned out of the DSM, is that it is a very... yeah, what you could call it, stigmatization term. It was always appointed, always directed to women, almost never to men, and always was a woman considered to be hysterical. While, for instance, a silent man was considered deep. But an outspoken woman was always termed hysterical. So, and I think that's the third main reason, and it's a very valid reason, that as a medical diagnosis, hysteria suddenly totally disappeared out of our society. But then you only need to look around or to turn on television or go online and you recognize it everywhere. Hysteria is everywhere, from the worldwide run on toilet paper amid the coronavirus crisis, the war against everything from corona to security to public safety, the madness of the housing market, the heated debates on climate change, while hysteria dominates the world states. So In a way, I tried in this book to analyze hysteria not from the angle of a medical disease with all the disadvantages that comes up with that, but I tried to analyze it as a sociological relevant term because it raises the question why our lives, which seems to run very smoothly for many people, are nevertheless so hysterical. Or so, to phrase it in another way, why is hysteria appearing at this moment after certain events in this period? So I try to switch it from a medical diagnosis to a more sociological diagnosis of our current society.
So what would, if we would look at a hysterical individual designated by somebody like Freud as hysterical, what would such a figure look like?
Well, you see in his cases of, in his female cases, it was, at least from the point of Sigmund Freud, always the idea that, that the cause of hysteria was a psychological or subconscious conflict that finds a physical outlet in all kind of hysterical attacks. And he described, at least Freud, this process as the repression of unpleasant memories and inappropriate thoughts rooted always in traumatic, often sexual experiences, which are subsequently expressed through all kinds of symptoms, such as paralysis, extreme stiffness, reduced appetite, mood swings, headaches, depression, insomnia, emotional speeches, and so on. And it was the psychological angle of hysteria. It's one of the three angles I discern in this book, how you can look at from an historical perspective to this phenomenon of hysteria.
Yeah, I see. And so it's repressed psychological elements that turn to that express themselves in physical discomfort or strange behaviors.
Yeah, and it was already, if you look at the history, like I told you, it's the oldest disease of mankind. You find traces of hysteria in the Egyptian times, and after that in the Greek times, because the ancient Greek and the Latin term hystericus is derived from the uterus. It's also the Latin word hystera means the womb of the woman. And it was believed, at least from Egyptian times to the Middle Ages, that hysteria was caused by the womb of the woman traveling through her body and triggering then a host of different symptoms on its way. And it dates already from 1900 before Christ, where all medical or female medical complaints were attributed to the wandering womb. There were descriptions, then, for instance, on Monday, the womb was thought to settle in the throat. On Tuesday, it latches onto the heart, causing nausea and vomiting. On Wednesday, it picks up the liver, making the woman lose her voice and grind her teeth, and so on. And the whole idea was, in order for hysteria to be cured, the womb of the woman must return to its natural place. And you see that all kinds of ways of achieving this, which, of course, had a highly sexual nature. Hippocrates, for instance, advised women suffering from hysteria attacks to moisten the womb in order to keep it from getting dehydrated, preferable by having sex. In the French Manuel de Médecine Pratique from 1800, they were suggesting to letting female women sniff the smell of singer leather or pouring bitter fluids into her mouth, also to encourage the womb to return to its place. And it was the somatic point of view towards hysteria. So there was a psychological point of view, it starts with Freud, and this was the most classic way of looking at hysteria, a more somatic view that started already in the Egyptian times and endured at least till 1700, 1800, when English doctors found out that, of course, it was impossible for a womb to wander around in the female body.
A fascinating idea. Maybe Because okay, you indicate that it has disappeared from the medical realm, but what elements of this notion of hysteria do we now see in the irrational group behaviors that you described?
Well, you still see that a lot of symptoms that in history were attributed to hysteria, like these emotions, these mood swings, this language, always talk about this exaggerated language that we're always in war with everything. And also the feeling of victimhood, that was also one of the diagnoses of hysteria, that this emotional outburst, and especially nowadays, because hysteria is turned from a single body to a collective phenomenon. It's always mass hysteria. There's this emotional outburst of hysteria that is always collective, that is part of an exaggerated language, and by a feeling of a victimhood of a bigger, a darker a force, that is still being the case with a lot of subjects I analyze in my book.
What would you say, because you give a great exhibition of these different works of art from history, are there any cases where we see, for instance, in a famous painting or so, a prime example of this this hysteria as a group phenomenon?
Well, for instance, not as a group phenomenon, but one example, one famous example is of course the hysterical uncontrolled laughter of the Joker in the eponymous film by Todd Phillips. After the Joker in his movie loses medication and counseling because of all kind of budget costs, you see that hysteria takes place in him, and by his laughter and by his actions, he's portrayed as an hysterical figure. But you also see it in a lot of literature, especially from the 18th century and the 19th century. You see it in the paintings of Francis Bacon, for instance, his famous Bacon paintings of the Pope, which were described by the French philosopher Gilles Deleuze as hysterical paintings. So you see it in a movie, in literature, in paintings. You can allocate all these places by pointing out and by directing out or by describing or trying to get in touch with this, like I told you, the oldest disease of mankind.
Yeah, and I understand. So applied to security, to the field of security, you indicate that many of our responses to a certain security incident are exaggerated and irrational, and that's what we might indicate as hysterical. How is this hysterical rather than, say, pessimist?
Well, I call it hysterical because I trace the language of politicians, for instance, towards an incident or an accident with public safety back to Hobbes. If you look at the talk, how politicians talk about public safety, it's always in an exaggerated language. We're always in war, for instance. We're in war with loitering youth in the Netherlands. We're in war with terrorists. We're in war with corona. We're in war with drugs. Always this aggression and this language of war, by any means necessary, to tackle a concrete problem. But like I told you, I'm also a criminologist. So I study public safety and security from a more longer angle than pure incidents. And if you look, for instance, at the Netherlands, but also at other European countries, and also at the United States, you see that criminality declines from approximately in Western Europe from 2000 on till this day. And on every scale, on murders, on manslaughter, there are of course exceptions, like online fraud, but that's very understandable because our society has turned totally digital. But all of the other objects or subjects, from manslaughter to murder to theft to burglary, goes down and down and down since 2000. But if you hear a minister of public safety speak, in the Netherlands or in any other country, then still you think we live in the most unsafe place on earth. He always speaks about this war. He always speaks of new measures, of new rules, of severe punishments, and so on. So in one way, I try to understand where this comes from, this language of hysteria. And you can trace it down to Hobbes. But I also try to understand why still politics talk in this way about sociological phenomenon, as, for instance, public safety and security. And you see then, and that's one of the conclusions in my book, that hysteria, of course, has, medically speaking, no longer exists. I told you that it was left out of the DSM at the end of the 1980s. So from a medical point of view, there is no hysteria anymore. But from a sociological point of view, and that's the main conclusion in my book, if you look at the economy, if you look how social media functions, if you look how issues like public safety functions, how politicians talk about these issues, the conclusion of my book has been that hysteria is no longer a medical model, but has turned into a business model in areas like economy, social media, and politics.
Fascinating. And I do, it's very visible that even if there is a period of very little security incidents, once there is one single very violent incident in taking place in the country, suddenly this fills all the newspapers and this fills all of our consciousness. So in that sense, I understand what you mean with it being a business case. Could you also give an example of a more economic business case of this this hysterical feeling?
Yeah, well, I live in Rotterdam, very close, for instance, to the Apple store. And when a new iPhone is invented, then you see people line up there, sleeping in front of the store. And everybody knows that the iPhone 13 is not that much different than the iPhone 12. And we all also know that the money we pay for the iPhone 13 is not really worth it. Still, the whole idea of the movement from an iPhone 12 to an iPhone 13 gets people out of their beds, sleep in front of shops, and so on. But you see it also on Black Friday, the famous consumer day, where people hop up, scramble, fight to get, at least as they think, all kind of bargains in shop. So everybody knows that on Black Friday, there are always no bargains at all. But still, you reframe it to economy, the invention of a new iPhone, of Black Friday, that causes so much frustration and emotions in us that we want to get this good, and that we try to do everything to get it by sleeping in front of the stores, by fighting it, by running into it, and so on.
I do agree that there's this super rational, hyperactive, exaggerated behavior towards certain phenomena. I was also struck because on the one hand, hysteria seems to be quite a defining term of our age, our decade, our way, current way of life. But on the other hand, there's also this sort of wave of more lethargical phenomenon such as burnout. Do you have an idea whether that there's a relation?
Well, at the same time, it's not all only a burnout, it's also a stress. And in some way, at least I start with my book at that point, that nowadays people tend to go to doctors for the stress, for the burnouts. And one way of explaining this is that we now live in a society which you could define as a society which has a moral overdrive. And in one way, this moral overdrive of our society, that everything needs to get faster, sooner, more efficient, that we live, of course, also in a neoliberal age of thinking, where there is no social glue anymore between us in our society, that we're totally dependent on ourselves. In a way, I think that's one of the reasons that hysteria is now so much around us as we see it. It's very difficult for a lot of people to live up, I think, or to live in current times. Questions as who am I? Where do I belong? How important is my language, my culture, my history? All these questions are not answered in a neoliberal discourse. And at the same time, you see that all kind of social meeting places, ranging from youth clubs to cornerstones, has disappeared or been replaced by big corporations. And in that way, you see that our current society, which has turned totally global, we're driven by a neoliberal thinking and social media, that in a way we feel, and that's one of the conclusions of my book, that the whole notion of belonging and of care and of trust, that is notions that are opposite of frustrations and anger, that these notions, especially belonging, feeling safe at a place, in some way or in another way, have become now, or have disappeared, or at stake. And in the end, I try to focus on that angle to explain why so many people nowadays feel in some way hysterical.
Did you see this because you went into these disadvantaged neighborhoods, for instance, Heerlesluis in Rotterdam? Did you see this expressed during that research?
Yeah, Heerlesluis is one of the five neighborhoods that are very disadvantaged neighborhoods in Rotterdam. And all these neighborhoods are on the south part of Rotterdam. And in these neighborhoods, still, if you compare it to other neighborhoods, still very safe neighborhoods, but if you compare it to the other neighborhoods on the other side of Rotterdam, are more unsafe neighborhoods. And the council, the municipality of Rotterdam, invented a couple of years ago neighborhood governance. And that means that officials of the municipality and the police and other organizations, public organizations, go to the neighborhood itself, ask if people want to gather in this neighborhood governance. And the whole idea is that these people in Heerlesluis raise then the biggest concerns what's going on in the neighborhood. And they make a top three out of it. And with this top three, next, this is the next step, the police and the municipality has to do something with this top three of annoyance, of problems, which are raised by the people themselves. So I spent 2 years in neighborhood governance in Heerlesluis, in the south of Rotterdam, with the topics I was curious at which topics they come up with, but also what the solutions are of the municipality and police to tackle these topics. And then in 2 years' time, you see that the boards and the meetings I was in with these people who live in Heerlesluis, we're getting more emotional and emotional, and the discussion became more frustrated, and there was more anger, and more people were leaving neighborhood government. And why? Because the police and the municipality did nothing with the problems they picked out or with the solutions they came up by themselves to tackle these problems. So in one way, the whole model of neighborhood governance, which was invented to calm down citizens, because the whole idea was we hear you and we do something about your problems, turned upside down. It was actually turned out after 2 years a vehicle for more hysteria, because at all the meetings I was, people were getting more anger, more frustrated. And why? Because in the end, the municipality and the police will actually listen to them, but did nothing do with the problems they raised or they collected in the neighborhood. It turned out to be a vehicle for hysteria, instead a vehicle for listening and calming down their emotions.
I wanted to turn to the positive note at the end of the interview, but this seems a good bridge to what you also indicate hysteria as. you indicate that hysteria is also sort of a potentially positive force. Did I get it correctly that it's has the potential to turn into a kind of rebellion? And did you see this in Rotterdam?
Well, I didn't see it in Rotterdam, but at the end of the book, I make a switch and I distinguish then two types of hysteria. And also the common type of hysteria is what I saw in these meetings, but I also see it in politics, in economy, on social media, and the language we use, the war against everything. And I frame that as a negative hysteria. But at the same time, I think hysteria and the history of hysteria shows that can also bring hope in that it can galvanize people into action in the same way, as you rightly tell, as a revolution can overthrow the establishment. If you look, for instance, from a historical point of view at hysteria, you see that at the end of the 19th century, so-called hysteria epidemics break out everywhere in Europe. And women were then diagnosed, rightly or not rightly, with hysteria and were locked up in hospitals and so on. But at the same time, in this Victorian area, at the same time, while many sufferers being institutionalized, it also inspired at that time social reforms aimed at giving women the same rights and opportunities as men. So the tightly laced corset disappeared and making space for more liberal views on marriage, on sexuality and the right to work. And this is not hysteria, I think, in its most destructive, sinister form, in which people will tear off their clothes and pull out of the hair. I'm talking now about a more constructive hysteria, which set things in motion and can do good. It's an engine for change in way making a contribution to the world. It acts for the greater good rather than out of self-interest. And here you see a political angle on hysteria. That hysteria can also mean that it can revolutionize or change the society in a better way.
And what's then the matter? Because this is about the actions of citizens, so to say. Is there also a message for, say, people who actually make policy? What can they do about this? Can they harness this energy? Should they try and work towards calming everybody down?
No, it's not, of course, calming people down. No, this emotion, frustration are always important. And in some way, I think it's good if people out them. So I have no problem at all with anger and with these frustrations we describe. I have no problem at all with it. I only think that if you're making policy, for instance, and let's make the example of public safety again. So with public safety, if you look at the history of the word security and the history of the word safety, for instance, in the Netherlands, then in the Netherlands, it has two meanings. In one way, it is a negative meaning, and this negative meaning is all about combating, fighting crime and disorder. And this is the language of the war. But at the same time, this is shows by the history of the word, of the Dutch word for security. The Dutch word is derived from the Middle Dutch word veilig, and the Old Frisian word veilig is from the 13th and 14th century. But that word, the original word of security, also means loyalty, trustworthiness, friendliness, belonging, feeling safe at a place. And you see the same angle in the Swedish word, trygghet, and also in the German word, geborgenheit, which is untranslatable in English. But it means, it also means or points out to a feeling that you're in a place which offers shelter and protection and feeling at home, for instance, a sense of belonging, as we put it in English, that invokes also a sense of security. So as a politician or a policymaker, you can do at least two things. Of course, you have to combat crime and disorder. Had no issue about it. But at the same time, you can also pinpoint to the second angle of the word security. And that is offer care, offer trust that people feel at home. And also these things, which I frame not as negative security, but as positive security, this requires a total different language, not the language of war. Total different tools than repressive instruments and a business like social contracts. In other words, how can you think about security without resorting to police, repression, to war, and so on? And this, in policy terms, it means that alongside the negative definition, security can also be understood in a more inclusive, affirmative manner. And in the latter case, I think it's more an issue of care and trust and belonging than in the first angle of the word, the negative security.
Well, that's a great note. I think we should actually conclude on that to end things with a positive feeling. Maybe two more things. So first of all, I would like to point out to our listeners that there's another empirical chapter in which you delved into the archives surrounding riots. And maybe you can just briefly bring this up, what you did.
Yeah, one chapter is on the history of race riots in the Netherlands. And in the early 1970s, there was a big race riot in the Netherlands. And it took for a week, for 7 days, where a local people in neighborhoods were throwing Molotov cocktails and into houses of Turkish and Moroccan people. And in that chapter, I was interested in the language politicians at that time used to describe or to analyze these race riots in the Netherlands. Because we know from sociological literature, there's always been the famous notion of moral panic. The notion comes from Stanley Cohen, that there is some kind of way of how these kind of events are described in media, in tabloids, and then are taken up in politics and then lead to all kind of measures. But what I found by going into the archives of the Netherlands, that at that time politicians spoke in a very calm, reflective way about these race riots. They didn't point out to the immigrants, they didn't point out to the local neighborhoods, but they tried to make up all kind of solutions to it. So there was no moral panic. Well, moral panic is always described to this kind of phenomena, for instance, race riots. And in this chapter, I tried to find out in which way moral panic is not the correct instrument to analyze these kind of examples. And I also tried to find out in which way panic is different than hysteria. And I also tried to find out why in the 70s, people took a total different language towards immigrants than nowadays you see with all kind of right-wing parties. We will talk in the way of they are wolves or they're coming in to rape our daughters. And that's the language in the Netherlands, which is much used when right-wing parties talk about immigrants or people who come from foreign countries to our country. But at that time, and it's only 50 years ago, there was a total different language. There was no moral panic after these riots. So I tried to find out in the archives what was the main reason behind this.
Fascinating. Maybe to conclude, so is this the direction that your future research is taking as well, or is there a different study or book project that you're working on currently?
Now I'm a professor of digital surveillance, so I'm writing now a book on surveillance, especially surveillance with big data and algorithms. Also there you see, of course, a little bit of hysteria, but more in the sense that the people still think that technology is the solution to everything, what Morozov called this techno-solutionalism. And with this book, I try to give a more ethical and a more calm and a more nuanced way of looking into what's happening nowadays with the surveillance that's taking place all around us. but also more ethical concern, how we must deal with algorithms and the, all the disadvantages of algorithms in instruments, for instance, like predictive policing, which turns out in a lot of cases to be discriminatory, to turn out self-fulfilling, and to have racist elements in it by itself. I'm working now on this book, and hopefully it will be published in a couple of years.
Seems like a very urgent topic, also in the Netherlands, but also abroad. Well, thank you once again for giving us a sneak peek into the book, and I would warmly invite everybody to take a look as well. Let me wish you a very pleasant day, and thank you once again, Professor Mark Schuilenburg.
Thanks for the conversation.
All right, bye-bye.